high requirements for my converts. Because the only people going to Orthodox rabbi are those who want to keep the Torah lifestyle, etc. You have the synagogues or people's children converted, but for the most part, 90% of people who are converted want to convert, and don't want to live the Torah lifestyle, they want to keep it. If it comes out of their parents, they're going to go to the Reform Reserve rabbi, because they're not going to go to religious.
Although after the fact is a valid conversion. The Shulchan Aruch says as much.
But the Moroccan rabbis, relying on a famous response of Maimonides, who had the same sort of case. And Maimonides said, it's better a case like this for the Beit Din to violate a small infraction for the larger good, for the betterment of this family, and this man or woman, they will not, will lose them entirely. If it's a woman, the children will be Jewish. But if we don't convert her husband, that's it. Because the husband and children will be raised as Christians. Now, of course, the people who converted accepted Judaism. But they would not have wanted to convert if they weren't going to be married. And if the rabbi refused to convert them, they still were going to marry or stay married to the non-Jew. So we're not dealing with the greatest tzaddikim. The people who converted, though, became traditional, as we might use the term in Morocco. But it was never an expectation that the economy things is going at all. Joining the people of Israel, sending their children to the Jewish school, becoming Shomer Shabbat, being involved in the community, that's what they wanted. And this, for many years, was the approach of the Israeli chief rabbinate. The Israeli chief rabbinate believed that in the land of Israel, Rav Zil's position on the Sukkot Mount, Rav Shlomo Bor and others, it's different than in the diaspora. We want to, the people, if they're getting involved with non-Jews, that we want to convert them, because in the land of Israel, we keep them in a Jewish environment. Rabbi Nessas, or Shalom Nessas, he died a few years ago. He wrote that if we don't convert the non-Jewish partner, they're going to get married civilly, and the non-Jew will cause the Jew to forget his religion, and the children won't be Jewish. And he says, quote, and by doing this, we saved many families who were pushed away in France, and we brought them close here after they, because we saw they came with good intentions. And he quotes a responsum of the Moroccan rabbis from the 1920s that said that in the same day and age, when our flock, our children, are getting involved in non-Jews, that is the only way we keep them. We have to, instead of pushing them away, we can't have any Orthodox approach. We're saying, no, you're not part of our community anymore. We have to bring them here. And Rebecca says, they said so in their day, that's the 1920s, Kalachomer, all the more so in our day, when the son is almost unannounced, because he's forced. And he's at university, and he meets a girl, he falls in love, and he says, it's unannounced, it's forced. If he comes on his own and asks her to convert to the thing, and she is willing, it is our obligation to help him. So that he and his children remain in the religion, and instead of losing one, converts. And so instead of losing one who assimilates to Christians, we save an entire family and bring them close to God, and this was the work of our holy forefathers, Abraham and Sarah. Note that he said it's our obligation to help these people for the sake of their children. I think most Orthodox rabbis in this country will be outraged by this approach. Help one who's already decided to intermarry. He's already left our fold. He can go to the conservator or form rabbi. Orthodox rabbis don't have that sense of responsibility to these people. They're not part of the community, so they're going to mess up. They didn't bring in an environment for actual, they didn't have four things. So if this is a part of this kind of community, do what you can to help them. But I will say that this approach is found all over the Islamic world. It's found specifically in Egypt. There was an Egyptian seer, Rabbi Eliyahu Chazan, the author of the Talmud Zayin, has Tshuva to Tshuva adopted the same approach. Other parts of the Ottoman Empire, I don't know what the practice was in Syria, and I will speak about the practice today in a few minutes, because I actually think, paradoxically, it comes from the same concern. Rabbi Ziel, who was the first Sephardic chief rabbi in the land of Israel, great work of authority, he's famous for his encouragement of conversion as a way of keeping the Jewish community together, because the same thing needs are going to have assimilation. And the choice is, when someone gets involved with a non-Jew, do we say they're not part of our community, then they're going to let them become reformed, or conservative, or intermarry, and we go on? Or do we say, okay, another person who's saying, we have people who have Shomer Shabbat, we have someone who's a non-Jew, let's try and make the situation better, let's try to convert the person. That was what the CEO's position. So what about the modern Syrian approach? I believe it's paradoxically actually falls into this model. Why? Because it too, in some ways, it was designed, as in the end, incidentally, here, the end of Argentina, to protect the released religious. Remember, as I said, in the Ashkenazic world, only religious people are going to go to the rabbi. Okay? The Orthodox rabbi. Especially if they have made a problem. Just whatever I do, just because I'm going to go get my vocal cords and try to get them. Rav Ziel, Rav Nessas, and Rav Chazan, and all the other Sephardic rabbis, why do they have this liberal approach to conversion? Because they are concerned with the people on the outskirts, on the edges, the margins. They want to keep them in the community. later in the United States, they too were concerned with the least religious. The ones most prepared to date a non-Jew. And they concluded that a ban on these conversions will strengthen the community and keep these marginal people in the fold. These people know that the non-Jewish girlfriend is never going to be accepted in the community, and the community is very important to them, then they're going to start off with her. However, in the other countries, they didn't have such a strong community, so they concluded that the only way to take care of the least religious, so the people on the margins, is precisely by then trying to welcome them, trying to work to convert them. But you see, both the Syrian community and the other Sephardi community have the same goal, the same rationale. Not a rejection of the outside, of the people leaving, but wanting to keep them in. The only question is, what's the best way to keep these marginal people in the fold? In the traditional Hashemite world, we don't have any marginal people. I mean, not Orthodox, so I don't show my Shabbat, what's dating on too? So those people don't go to my show. However, in the typical Sephardic community, you have all sorts of people. So it's a question of strategy. So I paradoxically, as I said, the Syrian approach, dealt in Argentina and then brought to America, is really very much of the Spartan model as it's directed against the marginal people, the people who would be willing to take the non-Jews. It's an inclusive position. Let's look for a second at Chacham Levadiah. Like I said, I'm sure everyone obviously knows, I think he gave the talk last year at the Spartan Center of Chacham Levadiah, why I think he is the most important, obviously most important rabbi in the world, but I think since the days of Maran the Shulchan Aruch, he's the most important Spartan rabbi. But he's concerned with the Pusik. He's concerned with, in addition to the typical Jew, he's concerned with the poor person who lives in the devote. He's concerned with the soldier. He's concerned with the semi-religious. Some people get Rabbi Yeshi, being Ashkenaz and Pusik. When he decides a question, he's really excited. It's like the people in the name Rock, and the people who are very religious. The poor person in the devote, the semi-religious, but these people are so far removed from him, he's denying his world. His decisions are focused on a very pious, ultra-Orthodox type of community. So, look, it's a very different model. Rabbi Levadia is a rabbi of the people. And I think that's why so many of his tshuvot, his responses, are written on two levels. He tells you often, this is the halakha. And then he says, but if you want to be strict, kabbalah bracha. You can do this. This is even more strict. This is better. Why do we have to constantly do this? You know, tell you this is the halakha, but you can be strict. I think he's telling you because, yes, there's the average person, and they should know this is not a God, and of course, if you're Shiva Bachman or whatever, and you want to be very pious, okay, there's room to be pious and be stringent. Like the Heter Mechira is here, which I'll get back to in a few minutes. If you want to be pious and not rely on the sale of the land, okay, he can be pious, but this is for everyone else. You know, the Ashkenazi posting, they're not concerned about the poor people that are living in the Moshav and all that. That's not their community. Chacham Levadiah is a national figure, but he's just following what the Spartan approach always was. It's only that he sees his flock, not just as his local day Knesset, but the entire country. So if anyone is surprised from last year, he said, a year and a half ago, another one of these sorts of things about seating at weddings. Because in Israel, you also have the Spartan, now it's because he wants the Spartan, some of the stringencies. You have these guys who come from Spartan Yeshiva, they don't want to have at their weddings men and women sitting together. It's not considered a problem. The Ashkenazi world, of course, will never happen. So the Ashkenazi yeshiva world says, if your parents don't want it, they want to have mixed seating, because that's how they know. Well, he says, it's okay, don't make a big deal about it. There's no problem. If you want to have separate seating, that's a nice thing, but if they don't want to, you don't make a fight about it. So you see, he's speaking on two different levels, because he's speaking not just to the yeshiva world, but to the real world. Now, in Eastern Europe, you also had this conception of a leader. Rabbi Kohan Sector, for example, Greater Mikrofonan spoke about this, who had was this kind of leader. But today, the Ashkenazi post-team are designing questions for people who spend their whole life in Orthodox communities, and in Israel, they're designing questions for people whose whole life are in the yeshiva world, where they never even worked there in yeshiva their entire life. These people who are asking the questions and whom the questions decide and are prepared to do anything the post-team says. Whatever the post-team says, they do. Now, there's a whole tradition of poskim saying things like, better not to say it, they're not going to listen to it. We can't say this because they won't listen. We have to find a way. That doesn't exist anymore for the Ashkenazi poskim because they're not dealing with regular lay people. Whatever the rabbi says, they're going to do. But for all thousand years, poskim by this dialectic between the law, the written law, and the community practice. So many Ashkenazim and Brahmi Yeshiva and the others, they don't even serve this thing. They would not allow it. And that's why you have all this quarrel today. Because today you can say what the book law says. You don't have to be so concerned, like for so many years, like the Tariq Muslims still are. Adam King is they're going to listen to, they have different levels of observance. So you get a very different model of how you decide Jewish law. And in general, the Sephardic Poskim have always been much more creative. They're able to look at the Halakha and see where it takes. Let me give you a few newer examples. In the 19th century, we begin to see the breakdown of family life. Young people were getting married without their parents' permission. Can you believe it? The difference is, these that you had, especially young girls, 13 and 14, they were getting married. Guys, and then these guys, either the parents cannot give their approval, and sometimes the guys just disappear, and then the girl is not doing now. Girl, 13, 14 years old, she's not doing now. What are you going to do? As we move into the 20th century, we begin to see the Aguna problem really taking off in the Sephardic world. The Sephardic world never had the Aguna problem. This was an Ashkenazi problem in the 19th century, but in the 20th century it has. Now, the Ashkenazi poskim were stymied by this problem. They were never able to come to any decisions. They were very afraid of originality in this area, and there's what to be afraid. I mean, don't look, you should, you can have mom root, it's very difficult. I have a Rebbe who likes to say that don't look, you should, is not my yom of shame. You know, when you go to Israel, I don't have a question. You on vacation, you 1 day or 2 days, or 3 weeks old, whatever you do, you're right. Because lots of people on each side of the issue, and it's a rabbinic thing, you know, yom of shame. The Pesach doesn't change when he has to determine a case of yom of shame. However, the Chol Yishuv, only the greatest poskim, decide the issues of family and law. Yet the fear of originality was really not that common in this article. In Egypt, for example, you had a great rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan in Alexandria, and another one in Cairo, Rabbi Paul ben Shimon. And they made takanot, ordinances, creeds, that no marriage should be carried out without the permission of the abbate and the abbate. Without 10 people being present and without a proper ketubah. Any other marriage, so in other words, you have a guy on the street, this is okay biblically. If a guy happens to pants all the time, a boy gives a girl and thinks her a dollar and says in front of two witnesses, you are a rabbi officially, you're betrothed to me, that's not a marriage that you get. I mean, it happens in cases like this. You say, what's the big deal? You're going to get, it is a big deal because you can't marry a Kohen. So most people are very careful if they can in some way. He had a sheet of this when I was in high school, and the right face ruled that he gave her a bottle cap, but it wasn't worth a penny, and therefore she doesn't need a guest. But there are cases where the really guest had to be given. There's questions like this appear in all the postgame. Let's get people on the buildings or hundreds of years, young people who think like that. So, one, the girl is bound to the boy. And yet, what did the rabbi say? They need a takana. Because the rabbis have the authority to take your money away. They're actually given that authority. So therefore, they can make a takana. But the technical application? Technical application is that the object you gave is no longer belongs to you. No longer has value. It's eminent domain. That's a very radical thing, though, because you're uprooting biblical law here. And the chief rabbi, the Ashkenazi rabbi, the Ashkenazi community in Cairo, his name was Aaron Cohen, he actually went along with this, with the great authority adopted. But nothing came of it. Why? Because in the Ashkenazic world, Rav Chaim was a prison. He was a radiant authority builder. He was asked about this, and he said, absolutely forbidden, and all the other Ashkenazic rabbis said, absolutely forbidden, we do not have the authority to make takanot, uproot biblical law, of waiting the girl to shut up the dog. That's pointing. So they're all letting up then. It's not in Egypt. In Egypt, they had a solution. The solution, this was announced in every Beit Knesset, and this solution exists in Egypt, as far as I know, until World War II. So they told the state of Israel, until the community dissolved. And that, have confidence in your own authorities, the Ashkenazi rabbis all over the world refused to implement it. In Egypt, they did. Throughout the Sephardic world, the great rabbis put forth all sorts of proposals. All sorts of proposals for the Aguna problem. From the Turkish rabbi, and Constantinople, they published a book. They had their solution to solve the Aguna problem from Kazan. In Alexandria, he had a solution, Rabbi Ziel, Rabbi Toledano, Rabbi Moshe Toledano, and others. They all had various solutions. The Ashkenazi shot them all down, refused to accept them. After all, we can understand, when a conservative rabbi is out there trying to come to solutions, The Orthodox, they're very wary. But the Sephardim are coming up with all sorts of original ideas. The Ashkenazi constantly shooting them down. We have, therefore, creativity in the Sephardic world that we don't have in the Ashkenazi world. In Ashkenazi, so many things are taken off the table for what I call meta-halak reasons. Not pure halakha, but because what we begin, where we'll lead to, etc., etc. I mean, it's hard. I'll just mention one of the very interesting creative things. I spoke about it in a Moroccan talk last year. We have Rabbi Yosef Meshas. Very interesting Moroccan posting. All sorts of original ideas. I'll just mention one. Only mind like that, he's a compliment. He was asked about using an electric penobra or phonic. Of course, all the astronauts are asked about it. Absolutely forbidden. And this. Meshas says, you know, why not? He says, oils, and safety, oils are nice. He says, it's oils for poor people. Electricity, it's a beautiful light. It says when the Beit HaMikdash is built, it guarantees that it's going to be an electric menorah, and therefore, I mean, but you have to know like that. It's not to be a financial analysis to say, oh, it's entrance to character. But this is a posting, we'll talk, an ancient posting, and he said, you know, this sort of creativity, and this is what Czar writes a lot about, is a tendency, a trend in this part of the world. Let me talk a little bit about takanot. Where's the takana? Takana is orphan. Takana, going back many, many hundreds of years. Takana, that's what it is against the conversion in the Syrian community, against the conversion for marriage. Takana are part of the history of Ashkenazi and Israeli. Takana is Ba'ar Ba'ar Tov, a few hundred years ago, various ordinances for communities. However, in modern times, the Ashkenazi world lacked the unity for Takana. Occasionally, they try to do things like, I don't know, the Buddha tries to pay a Takana, I didn't spend too much in some clubs for what I hear. Everyone gets an exemption, so it's meaningless. Not to mention that no one pays attention to what in the Ashkenazi world is no unity. Also, though, and this is more important, reading Haredi scholars, reading Ashkenazi poskim, said that we are no longer worthy of making takanot. And any takanah, which is seen as a compromise with modernity, is used as pasul. And you had not just takanot. People like Rashad and others, okay. Not yet a separate song for the victims of the Holocaust. You could say, you could go hakel in Israel, you could say, I mean, you could do anything. They call the hakel sukkah, nothing, no originality, nothing new. Yet, in the start of the world, hakel were very popular. There's hakel in Egypt, all over. What's the basis of hakel? It's in terms of Messiah, and I'll read it in Hebrew. After mentioning one hakel, he says, Apsha eitzel ati harapavura, Rebetzel said, even though takanot are not in accord with clear halakha, so I need takana, nevertheless, the case of takanot, they diverge from the halakha in accordance with the tradition of the time, as long as there is slight support in earlier or later posts. In other words, you have the halakha, but something's not working properly. Like, a crucible or something, you have to gain some addition. Because in the real world, people are not following it. So you need some sort of way that people can lend money of interest. Or, getting back to the Syrians' case, yes, you're supposed to treat converts, but what about the out of emergency situation, person leads intermarriage and all that? So you make a takana. Yes, you can violate the law, the justice goes to the convert, but takana has the authority, rabbis have the authority to make takanot in these areas. So the sheep rabbis in Israel in the 1940s, when Israel became a state, they wanted to keep matters of kosher mishpat, monetary matters, under the control of the rabbis. And the problem is, what about girls inheriting? According to the strict halakha, girls don't inherit. And yet no one in modern day times is going to accept a situation where girls don't inherit. So Rabbi Herzog wanted to make takanot that the girls inherit just like the boys. Even the Orthodox would accept the system otherwise. However, the Haredi is always the right thing to know. They refuse to go along. Even though our first time said if we don't do this, we're going to lose all of Kosher Mishpat. It'll become a civil, it'll be civil law. They won't go along and pick it off the ground. Yet in Morocco, what did they do? And this is just Morocco. This goes back to 2 years after the expulsion of Spain. The exile of the Castillo already made takanot that allowed girls to inherit. In ancient days, not a Torah, the woman gets married very young, she has a husband, but even in the 1600, it wasn't so simple. And in the 20th century, when they were reaffirming Sakonoka, they unified them across the whole country. They said girls and men are living on their own, they're getting married later, it's not fair, people don't want it. It's monetary matters, we have the authority. They made the Sakonoka. All the rabbis came together, they debated it, and when they concluded, the whole country was bound. And our first thing has this correspondence with the chief rabbi of Morocco on this. Rockets don't understand what the problem is. Maybe it's not going to happen. They don't know what it's like to be with the Ashkenazi, all the Mahokit, and the right wing, etc. And similar happened over in Sunni neighbor Iran. And Hakam was like, yeah, in 1970s, he gave his Hakamot to this thing. This should be the approach of everyone. They talk about Angel discusses this in one of his books, how it's absurd the Ashkenazi approach, the idea that we're not worthy of making Hakamot. Because the whole point of Hakamot is to respond to contemporary circumstances. But yes, you're not thorough, you know, we say that we're going to, every judge has to deal with this generation. Just like we're not as great as previous rabbis, but our lay people are not maybe as great. So, the Sardis have continued, have always done Takanot, it's been a part of their system. It was a living system, and unfortunately, in the Ashkenazic world, they refused to accept it in modern times. They say, today, you think I thought you really, today you have Takanot, they're influenced by our environment, they're influenced by the non Jewish world, and that's what we're doing. You see, all you get a sense of their concerns. They're influenced by the conservatives. They talk about women's rights, therefore, we're going to try to make women's rights. Finally, I understand what they're saying, that the Sardis may not have that concern. In fact, the Sardis had these very rabbinic conferences, which they came up with all sorts of talk on notes. One of the most interesting things they did there is they came up in the 1950s with a prenuptial agreement, and Rav Nestas wrote the responsum to explain the justification of when you marry, you bind yourself, and then if you get divorced, you must pay a certain amount of money every day until you give your wife a gift. Now, that had the American rabbis been aware of this, they could have adopted 50 years ago. They didn't know about it, and there was a big rabbi, Elihu, Rabbi Willen. He came up with a proposal about 20 years ago called the Willen Proposal, and now many rabbis from the RCA, when they do a wedding, they have a pickup sugar. I showed this to Rabbi Metzach, his chiva, to Rabbi Broy, Michael Broy. He's on the Bank of America about 10 years ago, and he read it and he said, this is the will of the proposal. So when the Ashkenazi in America came up with it, after such argument, just my focus, I'll tell you, the Rabbi Yoshi in Israel has banned it, said it's absolutely forbidden to use the RCA proposal. The Moroccan rabbis on their own came up with this in the 1950s, no machloket, no argument, simply this is what rabbis have to do, they have to work within the system to deal with the reality, and had they known about this, it would have saved them a lot of heartbeat. Because I don't know if you remember, the Jewish press, there was all this, they put this show, banned the RCA prenuptial, and there was back and forth. No one knew enough to say, we're not creating anything new, this is nothing special. This is simply what the Meraki Gedoli, and I tell you, the Meraki Gedoli knew more than any of these Russian issues, and those people arguing with these politicians. These were Gedoli, Gedoli Yisrael, and we're not involved in politics, and who focused. We have Ashkenazi, many of them just focused on Pilpul and study Talmud, they're very talented. But a lot of them like that, the Moroccan rabbis, their whole life was halakha l'maaseh, they spent their time, and that's the typical Sephardic approach. You spoke as a halakha, you're an expert in halakha, and instead of having to argue back and forth with the Yehuda and the RCA and the Yehuda Rabbanim, or the Jewish press, because he had problems too with his daughter, he came on the RCA side. He always was more Haredi, and then when that came, all of a sudden he's on the RCA side. But that whole argument was superfluous because the Gedolim of Morocco, who are greater than anything we have today, they had already made this decision and instituted it. They're going to say that this is Pasul and all the gifts that every marriage in Morocco for 40 years was a false marriage. And it was invalid. And all the gifts, and it's from there, all the Moroccans who got divorced are from there. I mean, the whole thing is incomprehensible. But so here we see those, the Moroccans. This is part of the approach. Let me mention a few minutes about Rabin Zion and Ciel. Those who want more information, Rabbi Angel has a whole book on it. He was a classic example of starting posting. A quality strong approach. Fearless. Sometimes he's too fearless. He has to backtrack. He was asked about going on like a train on Shabbat. We pay ahead of time. After all, no problem. What a Shabbat doesn't say there. We can go on a train on Shabbat. If you're going to shul or something, you're too far away. You know, Brooklyn, you have the T going in one direction. You just hop on and it's free. He said, you can do this. And other starting posting said the same thing. Then he saw those creating people were getting on to do all sorts of non-Torah things, and going just to visit friends, and that he changed his mind. Okay, if that's what you're going to be doing, I think it's not such a good idea. But the pure halakha, I think, was obvious. And this question came up in the Soviet Union. When the people started coming back to the front country in the 1980s, they were at, from some rich was asking this question. Can they take, because there was only one shul, the Coral Sea, in the garden, it was very far. And they had, you had to buy a monthly pass, and so went into your jacket, could you take the train to go to Philadelphia, to go to shul? And the answer was Salvation, but I kept asking them. And Salvation was well aware, you know, with conservatives and all this. He said, you know, in today's day and age, you cannot make a decision. Even though it means that they have to stay home, you can't give such a decision today. Conservatives who have to keep up, say you can drive the shul on Shabbat. He said, I saw that. But Lucille was looking at this from a pure halakhic standpoint. In fact, he had done Shiva, in which he had a rabbinic colleague who didn't want to get involved. He had a question about going in an elevator on Shabbat, when there's a doorman elevator, and he didn't want to answer to Lucille. He was afraid of my spoken of arguments. So Lucille says to him, and he said, you're abusive. He says, you're a rabbi. You must decide how to come. You can't say, I'm afraid of my spoken, and the arguments. And where I come from, rabbis are always very afraid. You know, that's not the. For Lucille saying you must decide to come out. He even believed we could establish a Sanhedrin. Now, what is the ultimate choice within the creativity of Sanhedrin? But the Ashkenazi refused to go along with it. And Jerome, who ever heard of this Sephardic Gadol, the anti-Zionist? Some are more Zionist than others. Some will say I think from India, some won't. But then the idea of the anti-Zionist being in opposition to the state, the Sephardic Gadol, and his inclusion of Rabbi Yad, that even as he's gone so far to the right in the last 20 years, apparently, shockingly, he still has a great love for the soldiers and a great love for, you know, what has been accomplished in the state. They supported the Greek state, they saw it as a gift from God. And this is another example of this part of rabbis not being influenced by extremism. The Ashkenazic rabbis, great rabbis, incredible Talmid Chachamim, yet many of them had such an extremist strain when it came to Zionism, they couldn't see anything good in it. And this extremism came to bear in a lot of decision-making. Already when he was running for election as chief rabbi, he said that the Sephardic posting followed me to them, and the Ashkenazi followed me to Shammai. And he's not the first. The Chida already speaks of the Chida, how the Ashkenazi posting, the Chida, their trade is gvura, strength. You know, the strength to tell the community that going the wrong way, asur, you need strength for that. But the Sephardic community is present. You know, the county that's trying to bring people in, so you see the differences. And there are historical reasons. Already, like a few years ago, this was understood. In fact, this year we saw that Chacham Avad Yah stood up against the entire Ashkenazic rabbinate, put another nail in his coffin in their mind. Because if you look at how he's describing the obtained their mind, their hair will stand on edge. They don't even consider him worthy to go anymore. Because he said we need to have Eta Mechira. Yes, if you don't want to say it, if you don't want to hold it, you don't have to hold it. But certainly it gets rid of the biblical prohibition. And of course, the whole idea should be that today is only a rabbinic law. So you can rely on these great rabbis. The first rabbi to come up with Eta Mechira was a Sephardic rabbi in the 18th century, the Shlomo Amar. The chief rabbi refused to do it this year. And the Ashkenazi had declared it forbidden. Chachamavaya in his own house. He signed it. So he's functioning as a parallel rabbi, as it were. And he's deciding for the state. In fact, I heard earlier in the year at Abba Yaffa in Flatbush, Rav Mazuz, the great, great rabbis of Israel, the Tunisians, German, he came and he spoke about the importance of why Chacham Avad Yah is doing this and why it's vital. And we should exaggerate the phenomenon of Ashkenazi strictness versus Sephardi leniency. It's not the issue. There are plenty of examples the other way around. The Sephardi are more strict on areas of Kashrut, that's not the issue. And there are Shulchan Aruch more strict in certain cases. What distinguishes the Sephardi approach is not leniency versus strictness, but what I call the meta factors. That those facts meta from the physics and metaphysics, Aristotle's works, not just what comes after, but what is vitally connected to. How do you regard the large Jewish community? That is, those who are not as religious as the posting, those who are not immediate followers, it's here that we see the real difference in modern times. In addition, there is found in the Sephardic posting, not uniquely to the Sephardic, but Moshe Feinstein has this as well, an openness to halakhic development, to see the halakha move in new directions, come with new ideas. New things I hadn't thought of before. Rabbi Zio explicitly in the introduction to his Mishpat Zio rejects the idea of Chadash HaTzimun HaTorah. That if something's new, we can't do it. He says, on the contrary, Torah is about Kiddush. Novelty, new things. Of course, they have to be in accordance with Halakha. That's all we trust the ability of them. They know. It's not for us. We can't determine that. So he says, we do not accept that. And you look at the writings. This is what Zohar has done. Look at the writings of Rechuladano and Rechazan and Rechazan and others and others. You see an originality. The notion of being able to decide halakha, instead of looking at all the meta halakha, is very important. I already mentioned the jealousy issue. What did that not get stopped? As I said, every Orthodox posting who dealt with this in the 50s, 60s, 70s always came back to the fact that we started by the non-Orthodox, non-religious, etc. Yet look at Chachamabadiyah, when you have Adat, in Volume 2. When he discusses about mitzvah, this is not even an issue. He just asks, you know what? It's not an initial offer. He doesn't mention non-Orthodox. He says, you know, is there a concept of celebrating, of recognizing the rural affinity? So he says, yes. Is the Sudan Mitzvah? Yes. And he goes through it. Just purely halacha. Purely a source of books. The Shai, others. All these concerns that dominate the Orthodox examination. So much so that the one of the great Orthodox most considered anyone who purposes about Mitzvah is a Tachin Mamre. Because they're agreeing to something that the non-Orthodox started. You don't have this in the Sephardic world. One place, however, that you can see some signs of what I call orthodoxy is actually in this article, and is actually in Lemel. To be sure, this isn't an orthodoxy of the sort that you find in Europe, because it's still an inclusive community. But we see in Lemel examples where traditional halakhic tolerance, Sephardic tolerance, and openness in halakhic development were actually challenged. In fact, I mean, I had previously said that this approach to conversion was not an example of this, but maybe this is one of an approach also. Now, what are the two examples? Famous examples. One is that there was a great rabbi in Italy named Eliel Ben Amozek. Came from Morocco. And he wrote a commentary on Chumash. And his commentary, when it reached Aleppo, it was burnt. Really extremist position in Aleppo. What was Ben Amozek's sin? Even though the great rabbi of Israel and North Africa liked this paper, he quoted non-Jews. He quoted non-Jewish authorities, and this is problematic. But this is the response you expect from Hungarians. I don't know if you've many have seen the video that's been going around recently in Israel that Harry himself said about the Haredi goes to the Sunni YMC, and those people that want to deal about, I'm talking about how they go out and destroy, you know, high-definition TV. I mean, that's what we think of when we think of the, you know, the Haredi, they're going out to protest and burn. But in the Sephardic world? The other example is when the law changed in Syria, the Ottomans made a change that when you transfer property, the property has to be recorded in the government office. And if it's not recorded in the government office, the transfer has no validity for secular law. And therefore you can't, you know, that's the only, it has validity, it only has validity in secular law if it's transferred. And all the great rabbis in the Ottoman Empire, rabbis of Turkey, and Iraq, and many Shai, and also the rabbis of Damascus, Rabbi Abu Lakia, the author of the Yitzhak, they all said that since this is what the law is, we have to do that, and therefore if a Jew gives another Jew property, and he doesn't record it in the same, we don't, as our basis, we don't accept it either, because it doesn't have validity. However, the Aleppo rabbis said, absolutely not, we do not accept it, and the Ben Ishchai writes that he can't understand what the problem is in the rabbis of Turkey. And they were actually able to put pressure against the rabbi in Damascus. But Rabbi Lofi is retract also. So you see here, this is an orthodox position, an extremist type position going on in Aleppo. The Aleppo rabbi also placed a ban on Chayra from Sabbath violators. You don't find this anywhere else. In the Sephardic River, Mustino actually says explicitly that he will not doesn't believe in excommunicating any Jew. But in the Ashkenazic world, that there are too many people left and right. You don't have to be shot by later. You can get along with either that they excommunicate you. So this attitude, which I see a few examples on that boat, is very much in line with Ashkenazic tradition in Israel, Jerusalem, and Hungary, and other places. But it doesn't seem to be a Sephardic approach. So where does it come from? I mean, there's another story. The Zohar brings this. B'nai B'rith. B'nai B'rith wanted to open a chapter on that boat. They came with letters from the Rishon LeZion of Israel, from other rabbis, and it opened all throughout the Sephardic world without any problem. In Aleppo, the rabbis put it under the ban. And yet the rabbis tell us, you know why they put it under the ban? Because they heard from Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld how dangerous it is. You know who Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld is? He was the rabbi in Jerusalem of the extremist Hungarian Orthodox. And we know, and I can't get into it now,
But the Aleppo rabbis who came to Israel, they somehow made a connection and became very attached to the extremist Hungarian ultra-Orthodoxy, and then they sent back letters and they influenced what was going on in Aleppo. So we have, ironically, in, out of the entire Spartan world, it's doubtful, precisely in Aleppo, that we see some examples of more of an Orthodox response than a traditional Spartan response. Not just, I mean, another example, yeah, Ron Harrell, some of you might know Harrell. He's a leading academic expert on the Serbian tradition. He wrote good, he's in the community as well. In discussing the ban on Benamosa's commentary, he says we have to look somewhere else to see where this, quote, orthodoxy comes in Aleppo, and it's banning, etc. It turns out that at the same time this was going on, there was a rabbi in Aleppo named Rafael Katzin. He started a reform congregation in Aleppo, just like in Europe. And the rabbis are very cognizant of this. Harrell sees this response to Ben Amosig and this Orthodox type of response of putting people under the ban, etc., as really in response to Rafael Katzin, or by Katzin's attempt to create a reformist congregation. Just like in Germany and Hungary, the rabbis respond in a certain way, so too in Aleppo, confronted with the same sort of reformism, you see that sort of response. What is certain, though, see how our points it out, is that the Orthodox community in Jerusalem, the one that from Sonnenfeld, they regard themselves as an eye of the religiosity. And they set themselves up against the other, against the non-religious. The rabbis of Aleppo, even though they seem to be adopting some tactics of the Orthodox of Jerusalem, they were never interested in setting up an Orthodox community. Because you know what the ERA is, it's a small community with very high walls. To be part of it, you have to have extremely high standards. And if you have a TV, they don't, of course, they don't let you in. If you wear a shingle, you're not even afraid of it. You know, you have to cut their hair. It's all nothing. We're talking a very high level. However, in that community, it's just the opposite. Their intention was, once again, motivated by a colonist or intent. They were intent on keeping the community together, keeping everyone in the community. And the only way they could do that, they thought, was by banning Ben Amosa and the others. The Ashkenazi community in Jerusalem, they were interested in keeping everyone out. So it's a very different type of conception. And you can connect me if I'm correct, if I'm wrong, but I think that this is still the model in the Sephardic world. That is having a big tent of trying to be an inclusive halakha. I don't think the goal was to set up standards which will keep people out of the community so that people begin to conclude that there's no place for me in here, that this is not my community anymore. You see, in the Ashkenazi world over the last 30 years, makes it very positive. We had much more increase in Shemirat Shabbat, but the old type of Jew who used to come, who sent his kids to Hebrew school, or they went to public school, it wasn't really Shemirat Shabbat, they no longer will come to our shuls anymore. And therefore, we no longer have a chance to influence them. They don't go. You know, people who drive to shul anymore to the Ashkenazi shuls. So we lost that type of Jew, and those are the people who built the Orthodoxy of America. I still think the Sephardic community, if you correct me if I'm wrong, the goal is not to set up standards to keep you out of the community, but to ensure that these very people that are so observant, they still feel comfortable that they can come to the community, and then of course they can influence, because it is still one community. Now, I wanted to, and everyone has to ask me, if I could discuss some modern day starting close to a different perspective, a whole Orthodox perspective. And truth be told, as who will regard the less religious as outside the fold, as not in the community. And I have no doubt that you have minor writers using this sort of approach. You might even have this in your own communities, I don't know. But I have not been able to find any major posting in the Sephardic, certainly not in the past, but not in today, who function this way. And I think precisely because the Sephardic community is still a traditional community, there is no organized opposition to rabbinic authority. Yes, of course, it's non-conformist. People are not so observant. But the synagogue they go to is the traditional synagogue. So when you don't have organized nonconformity, when you don't have opposition to the rabbis, when you don't have opposition to clericalism, you're not going to have this sort of orthodox approach of creating walls, of separating between them and us, because there's no battle between the more religious and the less religious. And I want to conclude by giving you what I think is a good example of this, which you might take this for granted, but in the Ashkenazic world, this is so interesting. And you got a picture here. From, if you go to Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu's website, you all know Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu, he built a huge yeshiva in Israel, and there's a whole video there. This is on the right left there. You have Joseph Safra, his wife, and you have a whole video there of the power and the whole celebration.
scripture, etc., etc., and there's a lot to talk about it. But let me just mention one thing. Can you imagine some of the Mr. Saffron, elegant, dignified, you know, such a traditional man? He never sees it, so I'm sure. And a woman who looks like this, dresses like this, she would have nothing. And she doesn't need money. And she's somewhere Shabbat, she gets money. She gives the Muslim Orthodox to Peter. And the Holy Spirit watch the video. Here's someone, obviously, showing them the same worlds of what about Yahweh. But she has to speak as her husband. But you see the kabbalahs for the rabbis and the residents, and you see the way she relates. And you see that how they welcome her. And they welcome him, even though they're not in their world on an everyday basis, but they're all in the same world. And there's so much, so if you put the pictures on the website, this is the sort of thing, this way it's so important, it shows you how society continues to encompass the wide ranging methods of observance, all together. This is so important, though, with respect for Torah. It's occurred to me, so I'll just say it, I think I'll look over this. It's the classic tshuva, which could never in a million years happen in the Ashkenazic world. But it happened in Turkey. Yochanan Kolachi. He was enough. If they could accept that the local prostitutes, the Jewish prostitutes, the Jewish brothel, they wanted to sell to the Aron, the Baroka, and give it to them. I think that's the question. Now, in the Ashkenazic world, first of all, any Jewish woman went up to this, what do you have in the Jewish community? She's far. But the idea that even the prostitute was so far removed, she's still part of the Jewish community, she's looking to show her son that before she wanted to get something. And you had this Argentina where you had the white slavery and all that. So I mean, the idea that that it shows something, which the Ashkenazi are unfortunately we don't ever have anymore. The idea that everyone is part of the community and that you still have it, and that even the prostitutes still have a sense of kedushah. Of course, they were not ashamed of what they were doing on us, but they knew what the problem was. They made their way one honor. And the question is, if he gave one people, they've got a lot of problems. You can't accept the gift, we have done so bad, and it's causing us a mess. But I mean, that sort of question incomprehensible. And that sort of question could be asked today, too, in the most Sephardic world, because this love of Torah is still there among all levels, and the Muslim recognize that. And I think, I hope at least, in this hour, I'm able to illuminate just the surface, so without getting into details, so you do another time if you're interested, of really what characterizes and what's so special about the Sephardic world, and it's something that I think should be on guard against to protect it, because there's great things in the Ashkenazic world, there's also great things in the Sephardic world, and this is the tradition, this is the way Jews live for thousands of years, and the Ashkenazi is certainly a different approach and not a traditional approach, the more modern approach. Out, and I think this is what makes the Sephardic world so special and what a legend. Thank you.
Maybe it's the way traditional Judaism used to be, and the way it was preserved in the Sephardic world,
without being so concerned with everything we do, we're being conservative, they just went out of the battle anymore. At the end of the day, we lost the battle. You say, how could we have, we won the battle. How could we have won it? We're still only 10%. In 1944, everyone knew Germany had lost. Even though the war still had 2 years left to go. We see what's happening to their children. We see how, unfortunately, they're intermarrying and calling. We see our families. Almost no assimilation. Communities with large children, pizza shops opening everywhere. I'm telling you, a bunch of pizza shops in the Jewish community. And we see the future is ours. Israel, one quarter or one third of Israel, or not. So much of us, to a certain extent. I mean, we're going up. So if we don't need to be afraid, and if we're not contemplating this battle anymore, then we can now, once again, maybe start, becoming more of a normal community in the sense that we don't have to be reactive. And that, I think, can only be good. And that's what I know Avi Weiss is trying to do, and I teach there. Open Orthodox synagogues. Once again, reach out to those people that we really couldn't reach out to for all these years. And I know it's created a lot of controversy. We can open a shul. Allow people to drive to the show, etc. Chabad can do it, but everyone knows they're all strange. But I mean, the Orthodox world, as a conservative, the Sephardic world, is not going to have to deal with this.
Those secular Jews of Israel, a lot of them are the Paradis. Do you think that the state
I agree with that statement. I guess that to some influence now, you have some Sephardi who are secularists, no question about it, but Rome minion opinion. I mean, for the most part, secularism has, most Sephardi are Sephardi or traditional, have a connection, even you have the Yemenites. I mean, you have the Yemenite murderers. You have like, the Yemenite murderers in jail in Yemen, 2,000 years, you have that one murderer. But even these people, you know, have connection. This idea that Sephardi have always had much more connection. They're not the Ashkenazi elite. Why do you say that there's a strong Sephardi secularism? No, secularism is Ashkenazi thing. Sephardi, yes, they're not so much about it. I have to beat the shop. But next time you're in Israel, you see that top stand. Who's he up on his wall? Picture of Chacham Avadia or Kaduri. Typical Ashkenazi, non-religious, if anyone on this wall doesn't care about that. The Sephardi shop has how many mandates? 10 or something? Most of these people are not our traditional. Sephardi society is a traditional society with different levels. They do not have Cleon Yud. It's not the top of an arm.
How may we evaluate the results of the Ashkenazi decision, the Ashkenazi trend of the splitting of the denomination versus the Sephardi tradition today? You said a couple of hundred years. Is there a way to evaluate? Is there a way to quantify?
It's hard to say. And just because the example I gave of Rafael Katzin's Reformist Congregation in Oslo, it shows that had this happened, what happened in Europe happened in the Sephardic world, they might very well have responded the same way. Now, there were people who had different conceptions in the Ashkenazi world. I don't agree with the approach that became dominant, but it's not hard to judge. The Ashkenazi made the correct choice in going into the denominations. For many years in America, the rabbis believed we could reach out, we could cooperate. It's probably very hard to say if they made a correct choice. Just like it's hard to say was the choice, you know, how they approached Hasidim. You know, they rejected Hasidim. Was that the right choice they're going to go? Should you try to co-opt Hasidim? These are the sorts of things that's hard to say. I have no idea. I mean, but we live with it. And, I don't know. It's really, it's still.
What is your opinion?
I don't know. It's hard to say. Yeah, you have Jewish communities that are certainly smart communities in the New York area. When he's one synagogue where everyone comes to, I was in one synagogue this last Shabbat. I don't know. It's hard to say. Threats were so much. When the Reform came on the scene, the idea was that they were trying to destroy Judaism. Today we can look at it and say, no, they weren't trying to destroy it. They had a different conception, and, you know, went back in time, maybe we could have worked with them. You know, what did they want? What did the Reformers want? They wanted to have a little few prayers in German. Is that so terrible? You probably have prayers in English to say a couple songs. I mean, the rabbis stood up so strong against it. Maybe